Good morning. Democracy and terror are in today's headlines. As three U.S. states vote in their primaries, much of the attention is focused on the aftermath of this morning's metro and airport attacks in Brussels. We'll talk with news analyst Neil Conan later this hour. Meanwhile, Hawaii Democrats are readying plans for Saturday's caucus, but are younger party members feeling conflicted over their choices? Representative Takashi Ono is in our studio with a few thoughts. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. A pair of St. Andrews Priory students have been looking for ways to recycle invasive algae, and they're on their way to the International Intel Science and Engineering Fair with their discoveries. And author Simon Winchester will tell us about his new book, Pacific, and the way a vast subject can be assembled as a kind of mosaic.
It's Tuesday, March 22nd. Stay here for the conversation. Next, the news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning, and it's been quite a morning so far.
Sure has. Well, one of the things that we've seen in this election cycle, looking at the local scene, is that younger members of the established parties have a different take on things than we've gotten used to with those parties. Yeah,
and it may be more than just, you know, generational. You know, it's from one generation to another where you always say, well, young people have a different idea.
Yeah.
But we're going to explore a little bit of that this morning. Now, today, Arizona, Utah, and Idaho are holding their primaries. Other far west states, Alaska, Washington, and Hawaii, will caucus on Saturday. Democrats only in the latter two states. In our state, how Hawaii's 34 delegates will be split in the Democratic Party presidential preference poll, or caucus to you and me, that could be a source of anxiety for some younger members polled by arguments for and against Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. To get a temperature check, Representative Takashi Ono, who also chairs a bipartisan coalition of legislators under 35, he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, folks.
Well, this morning, when we obviously have so much news, what's happening in Europe, but yet watching that played against what's happening in our world of democracy, particularly in the United States, and what we'll be experiencing as we move through the next many months, is seemingly almost, you know, more poignant. And looking specifically for Hawaii on Saturday, with those people that you talk to who are 35 and under, that leading bellwether group of millennials, are they feeling any different push or pull based on world events and based on where they are in their lives now?
Well, I think the actions of today in Brussels and earlier this year in France certainly are things that everyone, regardless of your age, is very important to. I don't know if whether foreign policy may play a larger part for some of my peers who are going to be voting in the coming preferential poll this Saturday. But I do think that all of them are going to be they do take this the chance of voting. They may be a first-time voter or a second-time voter. They do take that very seriously, and I do think that I do respect that, and I'm glad that they take the time and effort to really dig down into the details and find out what their candidates stand for.
Life at you know, 25 or 20 looks markedly different from life at 30 or 35, where you may have a marriage, a family, responsibilities, you know, feeling like you're really well into your life. That can mean that what's important is very different than what somebody who is 20 or 25 who may be activated by the adrenaline rush of being involved mm-hmm. in a presidential campaign. Are you seeing any of that in the younger members of the party who are working either for Bernie Sanders or for Hillary Clinton?
Yeah, absolutely. If you recall, you know, it's been 8 years since we had the chance as Democrats to really select our party's nominee for president. So this is 8 years in which younger peers of mine have been unable to voice their opinions on where they think the Oval Office, what those values and goals should be espoused. And I think that's one of the reasons why so many young people are excited about this coming election on both sides. It's I don't know if there's any sort of hard data or polling that I'm aware of I think this weekend is going to be largely dictated by turnout. It's, again, this Saturday at 1 p.m. But what does get a lot of young people excited about is the fact that it looks like on the other side of the aisle that all signs point to a Republican nominee of Donald Trump. I think for many people of my age group, the values and the aspirations of a candidacy by Donald Trump are not shared by us. And I think we're very excited to get involved in general election, this primary, and then the future general election to make sure that the Democratic nominee does make it to the White House.
Even in the GOP, those values that many see espoused by Mr. Trump are not consistent with their own. But it seems as if this is an election that's being driven by against Trump as opposed to for someone else.
Well, I think for myself, I feel that I'm very excited about my candidate. I think that many people who are going to be voting for the first time again are very excited. There are folks out there who I think are very noticeably keen to the issues that affect our generation. And many of those things, I think, to young voters are domestic issues. I think a lot of us have been curious about the prospect of our economy, about jobs, about education. And I think both candidates are talking to those issues.
As you talk about those issues, given the fact of what we've seen this morning, what we saw 4 months ago, foreign policy can't be negated or sort of relegated to a far corner. What do you hear when you talk to younger members of the party about foreign policy? Are they, you know, pretty hip to what's going on?
You know, I don't know if those are the issues that have stood out to some of the folks, again, who might be coming out of college or pre-marriage, pre-mortgage. Certainly if those people who have been plugged in and have been watching the debates, and I hope that many of my millennial generation fellows have been watching these debates, but I do think they certainly feel that they may have learned something and that this is a worthy part of the conversation, obviously. But outside of the debates, I don't know if there's a lot of activity surrounding foreign policy for either candidate. And that's just by kind of judging by conversations I have and then just the overwhelming deluge of social media that's playing into this election.
You bring up a point that many of the issues that those in the millennial generation, and really those are sort of two subsets, how they are approaching that has a lot to do with how they feel the effects of whatever may happen, as opposed to kind of concern for what's happening on the world stage. Is that painting with too broad a picture? A paintbrush?
Well, you know, a lot of, I think, if you can just picture yourself as, you know, someone coming out of college or getting your first job, I think the issues of concern to you are going to be, they may not include things like how necessarily our foreign policy or whether we, the price of oil per se. I think that when millennial voters go to vote this year, I hope that they cast their ballot for who they think is the best candidate, but they realize that afterwards, it is important to make sure that our Democratic nominee secures the White House. And unlike, you know, maybe the Republican Party, where I think there are some deep chasms, on the Democratic Party side, I feel that regardless of who we nominate, and that's a very important decision, but whomever we nominate, I hope that all millennials will get behind those folks. And I hope they also realize that beyond these exciting, sexy national races, like for the president of the United States, there are many other races that are just as important in state and local elections. And those are also ways where they can plug in.
There's always the hope that a big, sexy presidential race will get people activated locally. But sometimes we don't really see evidence of that, despite all the hope. Do you?
You know, it's going to be, if you recall, in the Obama years, we did have a higher turnout, even during the primary and general election. But when, you know, for those people who are voting for the first time, this is going to be the presidential, the Democratic presidential precinct poll. We're also going to have a primary election in August, and we'll have a general election in November. So this is one of three opportunities for them to get involved and vote. And again, this is Saturday at 1 p.m.
We'll look forward to seeing what happens that day. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, guys.
Takashi Ono is the state representative for District 27, which includes Liliha, Alava Heights, and Uano. He's a former third grade teacher. He also serves as chair of the Hawaii Futures Caucus, which is a bipartisan coalition of legislators under 35. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HBR2. It's now 8:14. Coming up, a fresh perspective on an approach to invasives. But first, your backyard quiz.
For obvious reasons, seafood is a dietary staple here in Hawaii. For today's backyard quiz, we're asking about a fish that has been a popular menu item since the days of the monarchy. The fish in question is known by several names, but is characterized by its distinctive red hue and its long, elegant tail. Once it was a favorite delicacy served only to ancient Hawaiian kings. The tender white flesh of this fish is now available to everyone. It's baked, grilled, or prepared raw as sashimi and is a regular staple at weddings, generally ranging from 1 to 18 pounds. Smaller catches are sometimes steamed whole and served with the head on. This flavorful fish is a common sight at the Honolulu Fish Market during the fall and winter when the harvest is at its highest. If you can tell us either the Hawaiian, Japanese, or full English name for this fish, you'll be today's winner. Extra points if you know all three, but unfortunately, no extra T-shirt, just the credit. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one to get it right gets the T-shirt.
Hi, good morning. I'm John Berger, editor of the second edition of Hawaiian Music and Musicians. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2. Find out more about the show at hawaiipublicradio.org/theconversation.
If you're looking for signs of hope for the future, you're likely to find them in local high school science projects. They're impressive not just for their ingenuity, but in the values they reflect, protective of resources and the planet in ways that earlier generations never were, committed to reversing the short-sighted patterns that have done so much damage in the past. Sri Cuddy is an 18-year-old senior at St. Andrew's Priory School, whose project has qualified again for the Intel International Science and Engineering Fair. She and her partner, Ariana Kim, have spent the last couple of years searching for ways to make use of invasive algae, and Sri is with us this morning. Good morning, Sri.
Good morning. Thank you for having me here.
When you and Ariana started on this project, Ariana came and told us about it on the show as it was just kind of getting underway. And the idea was that the invasive algae that, for example, clog up Kaneohe Bay can have some uses on land that haven't been implemented up to now, yeah?
Right. So what we figured out is that using macroalgae can be implemented on a local, national, and a global scale. And we really wanted to extend the applications of creating energy, renewable energy, creating carbon nanotubes, alternative fertilizer, as well as alternative animal feed.
So the algae that is currently gathered up in the bay with things like the super sucker,
right,
can be recycled in its entirety.
Mm-hmm. So you can use every single part of the macroalgae for various purposes, like the four that I just mentioned. And the great thing is that macroalgae is a wasteful substance. It's not currently used in any...
It's just thrown away.
Right, it's just thrown away.
Mm-hmm. So instead of throwing it away, you do what?
So what we're trying to do is ferment it using sewage or cow manure and then using the byproducts of that fermentation for various applications that help move us toward a sustainable world.
So you're taking it and composting it, in mm-hmm. effect. Is that an accurate description?
Right.
So by doing that, where do the nanotubes come in?
So the nanotubes are really the future.
We should define them first.
Right. So they're really the future of nanotechnology. And nanotubes can be used for a number of purposes, such as water filtration, prosthetics, and any other application you can think of. And so to create nanotubes, you need a pure carbon source. So currently,
a nanotube is a piece of material that's very lightweight and very strong.
Right, it's very lightweight, very strong, uh-huh. and it's really great for various things. So uh-huh. to create these, you need a pure carbon source. So what we figured out is that you can take out a substance called lignin from algae cells
uh-huh.
and use that to create carbon nanotubes instead of graphite, which has to be mined.
And mining, of course, is a non-renewable, is part of the non-renewable thinking that
right.
was around for a few thousand years before you guys came along,
yes.
right?
Right.
So what does it take and what are the costs involved, I guess, in converting that? Lignin, was that the term?
Right, lignin.
Converting lignin to nanotubes requires what kind of process?
So there actually isn't any...
To carbon, I'm sorry.
Right. So there's no process as of now. We're the first ones to kind of think of using lignin from algae cells. So we're trying to figure out a process on our own. We've come up with different sort of strategies, but we haven't really put a cost or a figure on it yet. But it's definitely plausible, as we've seen through various types of experimentation. So we're trying to come up with the method as of now.
So that's kind of where you're at, because, of
right.
course, the first question you're going to be asked for implementation is, okay, what's it going to cost me to make this conversion?
Right.
But assuming, in the hopes that a low-cost method could be found, this really could be a kind of breakthrough, huh?
Right. So instead of having to use, again, graphite, having to mine things, having to use unsustainable resources, you can use macroalgae, a wasteful substance that kills the ecosystem, that marine ecosystem. You can actually use it for amazing things like these.
I would think that there were probably other materials that are currently going to waste for which similar things can be said.
Right.
Idea being, well, for one thing, you see it as a source of pure carbon,
mm-hmm.
and that allows you to make the nanotubes. And then the rest can, in effect, just be used like any other waste material as fertilizer, as compost.
Right. So after you take out the lignin from algae, you can use the remaining carcass of the algae for fertilizer or animal feed or various other applications. So literally every part of the algae is going to be used, which is the great part. Everything is going to be used.
When you say use it for animal feed, so it has nutritious, nutritive properties? It has protein or?
It has. So right now we're testing the specific parts of the algae, but we know that red algae in particular has about the same nutritional values as currently used sources today, like corn and soybeans. So we know that it will be as effective.
You know, Shri, the difference between the world that I grew up in and the world that you grew up in is that I grew up in a world where we thought there was going to be an infinite amount of everything. I mean, that's an overly simplified view. But you never had that perspective, did you? You grew up with an understanding that we were running out of resources and we needed to reverse some trends.
Right. So Ariana and I actually created this project off of something we learned in Hawaiian history about how the Hawaiians used coconut trees to its max potential, how every single part of the coconut tree was used. So we wanted to make sure that all the parts of the algae were used in the same way for anything from fertilizer to the creation of prosthetics.
The fact that you were inspired by Hawaiian history kind of comes back to a thing that we see again and again, which is that a lot of ideas that were abandoned centuries ago mm-hmm. were actually pretty good ideas.
Right, they're really great ideas.
So where does it go from here? You're going to a couple of you're going to a national presentation of your idea.
So Ariana will be representing the both of us at a national symposium in Ohio in late April.
Uh-huh.
And the both of us will be representing this project next week at the Hawaii State and Science and Engineering Fair, and as well as the Intel International Science and Engineering Fair in May.
Has this been pretty exciting for the two of you?
It's been really exciting, yes.
I bet. How long has it been? It was a year or so ago we talked to Ariana, but the project was already a year or so old by then, right?
Right. So by now it's been about a year and a half, almost 2 years since we started.
Well, Sri, we're going to want to keep in touch about this, right?
Right.
As you become, you know, a captain of industry and this idea takes place all over the world. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. Sri Cuddy and her partner Ariana Kim will present their project the weekend of March 28th at the State Science and Engineering Fair at the Hawaii Convention Center. Again, as she said, at the Intel International Science and Engineering Fair in Phoenix, Arizona in May. And Sri is on her way to UH next year.
Oddly, Cuba and Japan share an obsession with baseball and being invaded by the U.S.
If Cuba opened its doors, it's easy to see Cuba becoming the number one or number two foreign source of professional baseball players within 5 or 10 years.
Can baseball make Cuba as much of an ally as Japan is now? Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
Station members make the connection between using this service and helping to pay for it. One way to demonstrate your loyalty is through continuous monthly giving. Mahalo to sustaining members Uta Shiotani of Wailuku, Rexy Adlawan of Honolulu, and Kate Foss of Waikoloa. As more listeners become sustainers, we can all look forward to fewer programming interruptions for fundraising. To become a sustaining member at the $10 a month level, call us at 955-8821 during business hours or go to hawaiipublicradio.org. And thanks. In September 2014, Honolulu Mayor Kirk Caldwell told us he had a, quote, bold, strong, controversial new proposal to shore up affordable housing. It would require more from developers, and although the city says they're continuing to give input, housing advocates wonder what's really happening with the plan. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has today's reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
So when this plan came out, it had a lot to do with how low-income rentals or moderately priced homes would be zoned and how much a developer would have to set aside for those areas. What's been happening since 2014?
Well, Anita Hofschneider looked into it because the mayor has not said much about it since then. He didn't mention it in his State of the City address earlier this year, so it's been a year and a half now. And what the city is saying is they're working on it. They're fine-tuning the details. They want to get it right before they introduce a bill to the council. They are consulting with developers. And by the way, they are consulting with consultants. They have now had two separate consultants that were hired to advise on this study to the tune of about $150,000 total. But still, so far, no plan. The concern from advocates of affordable housing, and I'll just name one, Faith Action for Community Equity, FACE, the Reverend Bob Nakata in particular, told Anita, the worry is that it's an election year. And, of course, the mayor is up for re-election. And there's pushback from developers who have said, some of them, that this solution by the mayor, this proposal, is just a Band-Aid fix, that it really would create a false real estate market.
And why would it be a Band-Aid?
Well, what you're really doing is you're asking a developer to set aside whenever they put up a new residential development on Oahu to include low or moderate priced units. So if you think about it, clearly that's taking a cut for their bottom line, for their investment, because that's why they, in fact, are building this. They may have good intentions to build housing, but primarily it is something that is an economic situation. And as you know, the cost for rental units and for housing in Hawaii is extraordinary. Now, we do already have some zoning changes that are in the law where you have to set aside a certain number of units that for people that meet a certain income level. This new proposal, it's inclusionary zoning. It's trying to bring more people that need housing into the market. The mayor, by the way, also that plan was looking at extending how long those units would actually remain affordable, from a minimum 10 years to more like 30 to even 60 years. So these are big things. If the developers do not comply by this plan, which again has to go before the council, they would have to pay a fee.
But hasn't the plan been scaled back, though, to make it a little bit more palatable to them?
It has, yeah. With consulting, they have scaled back some of the requirements. I think they've changed the income level a little bit. So they're trying to come up with a compromise solution. Again, the city doesn't want to present this to the council unless they have everything exactly right. And as you've also probably noticed, the council and the mayor have been clashing over affordable housing, have been clashing over homelessness. So you can see why the mayor wants to get this right. But again, the concern is he's also running for re-election. And although he's yet to draw a challenger, that could still happen.
Well, we'll see what the timeline looks on this after that election, perhaps. Thanks very much. Talk to you in the morning.
Thanks, Beth Ann. Bye-bye.
Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat and joins us daily for a reality check.
Recent low oil prices haven't meant good news for everyone. For workers in the oil-rich Scottish city of Aberdeen, it's actually bringing boatloads of bad news.
I think it's shocked a lot of people that it's happened so quickly and so dramatically. I certainly did not expect it to be this, you know, brutal and aggressive, and that really has shocked me.
I'm Molly Wood. What happened to Aberdeen? That's next time on Marketplace from APM.
This evening at 6, following selected shorts.
Good morning. I'm Reverend Dan Werning from the Hawaii Sacred Choir. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
And now getting back to today's news, ISIS attacks in Brussels, of course, still chaos in the first days of Europe's new immigration policy in Greece. The president plays for high stakes on his visit to Cuba, and we're just about halfway through the presidential primaries. There is a lot to talk about this morning with news analyst Neil Conan. He joins us now, as he does most Tuesdays, from his Macnut farm on the Big Island. And Neil, good morning. The news is still coming in from Brussels, but there seems to be no reason to doubt that this is another series of attacks by ISIS, that same group who carried out the attacks in Paris just 4 months ago.
Yes, good morning, Beth Ann. And it certainly does seem that these attacks today, you know, follow the arrest of Salah Abdeslam, the would-be suicide bomber who apparently changed his mind in Paris back in November, then escaped to Brussels and hid out there ever since. He was arrested in the same neighborhood where he grew up, the same neighborhood where he helped plot the attacks in Paris. According to his lawyer and to the authorities, he said he and his confederates were planning new attacks, and the fact that he was talking or reported to be talking may have prompted the attacks today.
This is also raising all kinds of questions about how many more ISIS members there could be in Europe, about how they've been able to hide, about the effectiveness of the police, even about how the EU and Belgium will respond.
Yeah, Prime Minister Faust said today, we are at war, all of Europe is at war. That's the same statement that French President Hollande used last October. Now, France, in response, stepped up aerial attacks on ISIS in Syria, though we've not heard a lot about that lately. It's unclear what a much smaller country like Belgium could do or whether the EU or Europe, as Prime Minister Valls tried to rally them, would respond. But we also have to remember that these attacks in Europe, you know, in Paris, now in Brussels, you know, these are horrible incidents, but they're news because they're unusual, because we have a fair amount of transparency into the investigations, because of our identification, many of us, with Europe. We don't hear so much when these scenes happen in Syria and in Iraq and in Lebanon and in Turkey. They happen much more frequently there, of course. Even when the most recent attack in Ankara just this week, this was in a tourist area, and some of those killed were U.S.-Israeli dual nationals.
We keep coming back to Syria in our conversations, both the conflict itself and certainly the spillover, which you're right, you can see all over Twitter, and millions of refugees are fleeing for their lives.
Last week you mentioned the anniversary that this war had started 5 years ago. Here's another number. Syria was a country of 20 million when this started. It's thought that half of them have now been forced to leave their homes. 10 million people, many, of course, still inside Syria, displaced internally, but millions are in refugee camps in Jordan and in Lebanon and especially in Turkey.
Which rather puts this flow of hundreds of thousands into Europe into some context, and many more are in camps just across Syria's borders.
Absolutely right. And you know, that deal between Turkey and the European Union, which we talked about earlier, it just went into effect yesterday. Absolute chaos thus far. But the crucial part of the deal is that theoretically, everyone who tries to reach Greece by what they're calling irregular methods, illegally, coming across from Turkey by boat, everyone will be sent back. For every Syrian sent back, Europe agrees to take in a Syrian refugee from one of those camps on the border, someone who went through the process of applying for asylum in an orderly way.
Yeah, an orderly and legal way. So if there's no reason for migrants to believe that they can eventually get to Germany or perhaps Sweden, there should also be no reason to risk that trip, is sort of the idea behind it, you know, with people who are smugglers and taking them in small boats across the Aegean. Yeah?
That's exactly the idea. But there are major problems with this. For example, under international law, if people arrive in Greece and ask for asylum, those cases have to be heard. You're not allowed by law just to, you know, send them back later the same day. And there's nothing like the number of, you know, judges and courts and all the associated bureaucracy to do this. There's no place for those people to live while their cases are heard. And this also leaves a whole lot of people out. Only some of these migrants are Syrians. There are, you know, Iraqis and Afghans and Somalis and Eritreans and a whole bunch of other nationalities. So what happens to them? And there are also 10 to 15,000 refugees of all nationalities who got to Greece before this deal took effect. They're mostly up on the Macedonian border. That border has been blocked, so they can't go forward. They don't want to go back. What happens to them? This is just a complete mess.
For the moment, I just want to leave that because I want to ask you about President Obama's trip to Cuba right now. He's at a ball game in Havana, the Cuban national team against the Tampa Bay Rays. He and his family have been touring the old city. They attended a state dinner. And, of course, yesterday the president had a meeting with Raul Castro. What do you make of this?
Not just a meeting with Raul Castro, where apparently they talked frankly. That's a diplomatese for we had an argument. But they also had a news conference, which was really interesting. You know, the dictator of Cuba forced to take questions from independent reporters. This never happens. And one of them, somebody with Cuban ties from CNN, asked him about political prisoners in Cuba. And for that moment, just at that moment, you know, that mask of diplomacy slipped, and you could see rage on Raul Castro's face, you know, at the, you know, the effrontery, the indignity of being publicly held to account. And it was the moment that, you know, sort of symbolized the risks, I think, the president is taking with this opening to Cuba. How will American business and tourism and, you know, and all the rest change this country? Will it become more open and less repressive? Can an aged and brittle communist leadership adjust, or is it going to crack down like we saw with the arrests of dissidents the day before the president arrived? Now, Cuba has no choice. It has to change. There's no Soviet Union to prop it up anymore. There's no oil subsidies from Venezuela. They're going to be ending soon. It has to come to terms with the United States one way or another. It has to make the transition from the Castros to new leadership. But change doesn't necessarily always mean change for the better. And what Cuba looks like 5 years from now is going to be an important part of how we view the Obama presidency down the road.
Okay, 5 years from now, though, Barack Obama's successor may be in his or her second term. A quick review of where the nominating process stands now before I'll let you go. As we mentioned, we're just about halfway through, right?
Yeah, and I think last Tuesday's results are going to prove to have been decisive. Hillary Clinton won all five states, three of them by very big margins. She's up by more than 300 pledged delegates, and you can see her campaign begin to shift away from the primaries and Bernie Sanders and towards Donald Trump and the general election come November.
Not good news for the Sanders campaign, but is some of this premature? I mean, Sanders says there are a lot of states he thinks he can still win in the West starting today.
Yep, he should win the caucuses in Idaho and Utah today, and he should win those big. It's harder to tell about Arizona. There's not been much polling. The last polls we saw had Secretary Clinton up by double digits, maybe 20 points. Now, we've seen that hold up in Ohio. We've seen that fade away rapidly in Michigan. But in any case, it looks like that's going to be at least close enough. Split the delegates. Again, Bernie Sanders can't be affording to split races very much. But in any case, down the road, he hopes to do very well in places like Washington State and Wisconsin and here in Hawaii. There have been a few ads on the air, you may have noticed. That's coming up on Saturday for the Democrats. But it's hard to overstate the depth of the hole that he's in. He would have to win about 60% of all the delegates from here on out. We saw President Obama tell Democratic fundraisers a few days ago that, you know, it's time to start wrapping this thing up. Just this week, progressive champion Senator Elizabeth Warren started a Twitter war with Donald Trump. Her mind is on November. And, you know, for Democrats, the prospect of candidate Trump is getting pretty persuasive.
The Stop Trump movement in the Republican Party doesn't seem to have coalesced, though.
No, it hasn't at all. And he looks at to big win big in Arizona today. That's a winner-take-all state. He will lose in Utah. He is decidedly unpopular among Mormons and did not help himself by attacking Mitt Romney's faith the other day. The question in Utah is 50%. If Ted Cruz gets over 50%, he gets all of Utah's delegates. If he's under 50%, the split is proportional. And then Donald Trump gets that much harder to stop.
So do you think he's going to get that magic number of delegates, the number he needs to win the nomination, that, what, 1237?
Probably. It could be close, but probably he will. And what happens to the Republican Party at that point is anybody's guess. But if you want to get an idea of what a candidate Trump or President Trump might be like, I urge you to read the transcript of his meeting yesterday with the editorial board of the Washington Post. It's available online, or you can listen to it, too, if you want. At several points, you know, it ranges from delusional to incoherent.
I'm glad you said that.
There's a scary moment where he's asked whether he would use tactical nuclear weapons against ISIS. And he declines, you know, he sort of fudges an answer. And he's asked again, you know, what about this? And he turns around and instead of answering, he says, hey, you know, what a beautiful bunch of people we have here. Would you introduce yourselves? This is scary, and it's not the first time he's been scary about nuclear weapons. If you remember one of the early debates, he was asked, you know, which part of the nuclear triad would he prioritize in modernization? And the answer that he gave made it absolutely clear he had no clue what the nuclear triad is, you know, the basis of the United States' strategic nuclear posture. His ignorance, his demagogue, it's overwhelming. It's really scary. It makes me wish we'd get back to that ball game in Havana.
All right, then I'm going to let you do that. So what's the score? Do you know?
Last time I checked, it was nothing. Still in the first inning, though, but I assume they've moved on since then.
All right, well, we're going to leave it there, but I'll talk to you next week. Thanks a lot, Neil.
You bet that,
man. News analyst Neil Conan joins us most Tuesdays from the farm. You can also hear his Pacific News Minutes right here on Hawaii Public Radio. Now something a little more palatable, perhaps, today's backyard quiz, in which we asked you about a red-colored fish that has long been considered a delicacy in the Hawaiian Islands. It's commonly known by its Japanese name, but also has Hawaiian and English monikers. Our mystery fish is a bottom feeder and resides at great depths from about 100 to 150 fathoms. The catch we receive here in Hawaii typically originates in the remote northwest Hawaiian islands. The sparsely populated atolls, which stretch for thousands of miles northwest of Kauai County, provide a rich fishery for many species, including the one we asked you about today. It can be found as far away as Madagascar. On the menu, you'll see it listed as onaga. It's popular throughout Southeast Asia and is harvested through the Pacific and Indian Oceans. Many similar species exist in waters of the Atlantic Ocean, but these are biologically different from the Hawaiian long-tailed red snapper, or ulaula, the names we were looking for this morning. It's now 8:46. That's the quiz. If you've got one, send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from the College of Business at Hawaii Pacific University, whose MBA FlexPlus program offers a blend of classroom and online classes to fit the lives of working professionals. hpu.edu/business.
Author Simon Winchester sees the Pacific as a place where cultures clash, a place where there's challenge in the air as East collides with West. For him, as he crafted his new book, Pacific, the challenge was giving shape to his admittedly vast subject. He mates it by choosing stories from atom bomb tests and the Pueblo incident to the voyages of the Hokulea and the premiere of the movie Gidget that combine to tell a greater story, one where by the end, he finds signs of hope. His narrative begins in 1950.
I decided to look at all the events that occurred in and around the Pacific that made the newspapers and magazines and the scientific journal articles and try and winnow them down to about 10 that seemed to me to be important and emblematic, and then use those 10 in chronological order to try and tell the story in a sort of mosaic form of today's Pacific Ocean.
Well, it to me, Simon, it absolutely worked. And the thing that struck me was that these are stories that will be of varying degrees of familiarity to your readers, that people will remember a little about the Pueblo incident, but there will be a great deal they don't remember. And I'm also find myself shocked that people know as little as they do about the bomb testing that went on in the Pacific in the 50s.
It is extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, of course, not terribly far from where you are in Hawaii, just a couple of thousand miles to your west. Even there, I found relatively little was known about what happened mainly in Bikini and Iniwetok. But they were extraordinary events, and the way that the American military, and I'm not being critical of the Americans because I'm an American myself now and have been now for the past 4 years, but how they sold it to the Bikinians, essentially quoting the Bible to these newly converted Christian Bikinians and saying, if you look at Exodus 13, verse 21, where it talks about the Israelites being led out of slavery in Egypt behind a pillar of fire, well, we Americans, they said to the Bikinians, we Americans can create a pillar of fire and a pillar of smoke with this new technology that we've created. So will you regard that as a symbol of doing the Lord's work? And will you kindly, therefore, leave Bikini for a while we create more of these pillars of fire and smoke? And the Bikinians said, innocently enough, yes, we will. I mean, it strikes me as a terribly cynical use of religion to persuade people to leave their homes and then completely destroy their island and transport these people to a little refugee island called Kili in the south of the Marshall Islands, where there's no atoll, there are no coconut trees, there's no port. They have to have their food airdropped to them, and it's much of it, the food is, of course, Coca-Cola and Spam, and so the people are getting diabetes and all sorts of health problems, and now their island is being flooded because of rising sea levels. It's a very unhappy story, and Bikini and the Marshall Islands generally.
And in many ways, a kind of a last gasp of the colonial attitudes of, the the European asserting his rights over non-white peoples of the world, not in taking their land, but taking the entire cultural identity and using their location for our own purposes, yeah?
Well, and that strikes me, I mean, that's one of the, it wasn't intentional at the start, but many of the chapters talk about that kind of thing, about, you know, the colonial, the European colonists essentially began pulling out of the Pacific, I suppose, after Dien Bien Phu in Vietnam in the 1950s,
yeah.
And then the British left Hong Kong, and of course the Japanese were forced to leave after the World War II, and the Germans have left, and most of the French have left, except for their sort of relic islands in the central South Pacific. So most Europeans have now left, and the Pacific Islanders are now being left to their own devices after having been colonized, and they're, you know, irradiated, and their people enslaved, or at least subjected to all sorts of stringent labor conditions, or their oceans overfished or polluted. So we Westerners have not done very well by the Pacific Ocean, and now that the Pacific Ocean peoples have got back control of their ocean, perhaps things will go rather better.
You've been traveling recently in Australia and New Zealand and seeing some signs of hope in that regard, haven't you?
Well, yes, in all sorts of ways. I mean, one of the things that I'm actually writing about at the moment here in Massachusetts is the way that the Aboriginals in Australia and the Maoris in New Zealand, who had a particularly bad relationship, hardly surprisingly, with the people, the Europeans that colonized those two countries, have since the 1970s and 80s enjoyed a, or are beginning to enjoy, a rather better relationship. And one of the sort of small symbolic things that I'm noticing is that every time I stood up to give a speech, whether it was in Perth or Adelaide or Melbourne or Wellington, the person that organized it would give a 30-second peroration out of respect to the original owners of the land, whether it was a particular Aboriginal family or a particular Maori family. And that, to the local Aboriginals and the local Maoris, does give them some degree of sort of comfort. At last, you're acknowledging, they say, that you white people were not the original settlers here, that we were, and we've been here for thousands of years in the case of the Aboriginals. It's the sort of thing I'd like to see happen here in the United States, because, of course, the North American Indians, who are, of course, genetically a Pacific people as well, since they came over the land bridge, the Bering Strait land bridge, they have been accorded very little respect. And I'd sort of rather like to see this rather touching ceremony begin here in America. Probably never will, but it's something that I certainly found encouraging both in New Zealand and in Australia.
You also chronicle in your book what has happened in Hawaii in the, 50 years now of the Hawaiian Renaissance.
Yes, and I actually end the book talking about Hokulea, which I imagine you have heard about all too often since she was launched in, 1976. But I was intrigued by this new, the voyage that she began in May 2014 when she set off for Maui on this Malama Honua voyage around the world, mm-hmm. leaving relatively familiar waters of the Pacific Ocean and using Polynesian non-instrumental navigation techniques to cross, first of all, the Indian Ocean, and latterly the Atlantic Ocean, and this she has done with remarkable speed. I mean, she made the east coast of South Africa about 4 months ago, and then she's been crossing diagonally from south east to northwest across the Pacific. She's now in, of all places, Cuba, and the thought is that in the next day or so, maybe even today, her crew will meet the Hawaiian president, as it were, President Obama. And what a wonderfully symbolic gesture that would be, that he will see a craft that has come all this way from Maui over the last, nearly 2 years, without any sextant or compass or wristwatch or, of course, GPS to guide her there. I think he'll be very proud indeed. And they, if they do get their meeting, I think we'll be thrilled.
Well, you know, it's also, if you just sort of isolate that story, Simon, it has all the themes that you could hope for contained within that one narrative, doesn't it?
Well, it really does, and I, that's why I end the book with this epilogue about it, because it strikes me that after all the damage that we non-Pacific peoples have done to the ocean and her peoples, that here at last is a resurgence of not just a Hawaiian renaissance, but a pan-Pacific renaissance presenting itself to the outside world in another sort of former colonial situation, Cuba, to an American president with these wonderful semi-Pacific origins. So I think so many strands all come together, and I just hope Obama will meet them.
Simon Winchester is the author of Pacific, published by HarperCollins. His other books include Krakatoa, Atlantic, and The Professor and the Madman.
Pacific blue.
A trip to Croatia can make you think you've traveled back to a different century.
There's still a lot of old ways. People still mow their lawns with a sling blade, and there's still cattle on the first floor of some people's houses.
And a visit to Albania comes with a big welcome.
They, I think, are super friendly because they're just so happy that the world has decided to come visit them.
Explore the Balkans plus Northern Italy on the next Travel with Rick Steves.
This afternoon at 4, right after Fresh Air.
Beth Ann, Simon Winchester describes his book Pacific as a mosaic, and that's an effective description because he takes stories within the larger story and through them creates sheds light. It's a fascinating book. You're going to like it.
Well, I'm glad because
I've been hoarding our copy.
Our copy. I started to give it to you. Now I get it back to finish
that's
it.
Right.
But yeah, really very enjoyable. Yeah, reading, and as you say, bits and pieces that begin to shape the whole in a different way than perhaps we might have looked at in the past. Really nice interview you got to do with him. I'm sure it could have gone on and on.
Yes, it could have.
So what you have for us for tomorrow?
Well, tomorrow an arts curator is going to look at the term that drives arts curator crazy when somebody says, my kid could do that.
Yeah, I heard that one once or twice. In the meantime, we like to hear from you, and you can call our talk back line anytime you like. That number is 808-792-8217, or if you like email, we've got that too. It's talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can post comments on Facebook. Our page is Hawaii Conversation, or tweet us at HI Conversation, or tweet me at BKOZHPR.
And if you missed any of this show or want a past show, they're on the HPR2 archive, which is under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll meet you in the morning right here for more of The Conversation.